Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Deirdre Nealon. Nealon is an associate professor of bioethics and humanities at SUNY Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. She teaches medical creative writing workshops and is a faculty tutor for medical students in ethical, legal, and social issues in medicine. She is also editor of The Healing Muse, Upstate's Journal of Literary and Visual Arts, which just published its 10th anniversary issue this past fall. Nealon's scholarly and creative writing has appeared in World Literature Today, Academic Medicine, and North Dakota Quarterly. And welcome to the show.
Thanks, Tish. It's great to be here.
Now, I want to begin by asking you, what initially got you interested in combining writing with medical concerns and medical culture?
Ooh, let's see. That would be one wants to work and eat and have a paycheck. And so,
but it's so specific.
I know it is, but my route to it was rather circuitous. I wanted to teach literature in regular university settings, and I got a job part-time at Upstate and met people in the gross anatomy department who were looking for tutors and started working with them, and then parlayed that into a job with the newly formed Center for Bioethics and Humanities, which was a great place because we are trying to have medical students not lose that human part of themselves during the arduous 4 years of sciences that they undergo when they start their training. So the Center for Bioethics and Humanities moves students back and forth from the great ethical dilemmas that are going to be part of their lives as clinicians into the realm of, well, you could write about what you're seeing, you could think about what you're seeing, you could read and reflect. And so the literature came into being with that.
Oh, I think it's really important, and I think it's fascinating, too. Now, you teach medical creative writing workshops. Now, what does that entail?
That's wonderful. That for me, anyway, it entails asking the medical students when it's time for them to take electives, if there's a part of them that would like to explore the creative side of themselves. Because, you know, many of our students come from backgrounds that were not just science solely. They were people who wanted to read and write when they were undergrads. Mm. And so what we're trying to do in the third and fourth years is to provide them, during those units when they take an extra class in family medicine or an extra class in ethics, they could also take an extra class in creative writing. And we read other medical memoirs that have been written by other physicians. But we try and talk to them about this is something that you could do, because the public is very hungry to read about what their nurses and physicians think. A lot of times I think patients think they're the only ones who are feeling what's happening to them. And it's actually very true that many clinicians feel deeply, but the medical training teaches them to pull back. You can't be too emotionally involved. And so to allow them to do some of the creative writing that we certainly encourage other people to do in normal walks of life is, I think, a very valuable tool for them.
It is. So by the time that they're taking these classes from you, have they already lost their resistance? I would think scientists and clinicians would resist showing any kinds of emotion.
Well, you know, since it's an elective, it's a self-selecting group of people, so they are, at some level anyway, open to exploring the idea that they might have a talent for doing more than, you know, surgery.
So do you try to encourage them to talk about their medical training and some of their experiences with real patients and put it into fiction or short stories?
Yes, we do.
Or diaries? Or?
Yes. I think that it's beneficial for them as people, and it's beneficial for them as clinicians to spend the time and reflection that writing requires. You can't just dash something off. When you really want to write about an experience, you sit there and you think about that experience. And so I think that we try and teach in bioethics that every patient comes to you with a story, and that it's more than a diagnosis that they're looking for. They're looking for someone to hear and reflect upon their story. So I think it's a natural outgrowth from that to have the clinician want to sit down and think about what I did today. You know, what was that like?
I would think it would make them better doctors if they could get in touch with that side of themselves.
I think that it does. We certainly have had, through the Healing Muse, testimonies from physicians and nurses who have been published talking about what happened after their story or poem or essay appeared, it engaged a dialogue between them and their patients or them and family members. And they say that, you know, the experience is very wonderful for them.
Yeah, I can imagine. Because it seems to me, even in my limited experience, I haven't had that much experience having to be in hospitals or around doctors, they have things in mind and then they have outcomes in mind, but they don't think about what they're actually putting people through, a lot of physicians, and what it does to the spirit and the soul. And
yeah, I think that's part of this is the problem with managed care and how much time physicians are now allotted to spend with patients. But I think that they really do feel deeply what they are asking their patients to do. But I think if they were to vocalize that, I think they're afraid that they might scare you off doing what they think you need to do. I mean, you know, chemotherapy is not fun. Radiation therapy is not fun. Many of the treatments that we give have side effects, and they're trying to be honest about all of that stuff. But I think probably some of what you sense on their part is more reluctance than a non-realization of what it is you're going through.
I do hope so. Now, I know another one of your areas of interest is patient narratives.
Yes.
Now, to tell us how valuable that is for patients to be able to.
Well, you know, when you enter the world of illness, when either you or someone you love has been diagnosed with something serious, you feel so much out of control. You feel as though your world, and it has, been turned upside down. And it's very important for you to regain a sense of, I can do this. I can see an end to it, or I know what I have to do to get to the end of it. I think writing or reflecting, reading, these are ways that people can organize their experience. So sometimes a patient narrative to me is a way of having gone through something that was truly ugly and trying to recapture from restating what it was like a sense of, okay, it was bad, but I'm here. And I'm not bad. It's, you know, I'm still me. I think a lot of times people going through a health crisis start to think of themselves, because they're being treated like this, as the illness. You know, you're the diabetic. Instead of, I'm Deirdre with diabetes, I become the diabetic. And then I'm supposed to fit into this narrow box that doesn't really exist, because obviously my diabetes is not necessarily what your diabetes is. So I think sometimes when we write about that, we open up other people's eyes as to what it is we have gone through. And that, again, I think that engenders a nice, honest dialogue.
I love reading about people's experiences in the medical world. It's like communiques from a different country.
Totally,
which is very interesting.
I agree. I mean, where else are you on the lines between life and death? And it isn't always an unhappy ending. I mean, people oftentimes think, oh, this must be so depressing. But it's not. It's a world of very exciting rebirths for people, because you are changed by what's happening.
Oh, yeah. The before and after.
The before and after,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Now, I want you to read an excerpt from a piece that you wrote. Okay. And it's called What Remains. And do you want to set it up for us?
Sure. I would love to. This is something that's extremely personal to me. I am a fiction writer, but having gone through the loss of my partner, and it was a very difficult, almost 11-month period from the diagnosis of a brain tumor to her death, I felt what I've just finished, you know, talking to you about. And it was very interesting to have been a teacher talking about things theoretically and then being a person who actually had lived some of what we had been talking about in literature classes. You know, I teach a class on death and dying, and it's very different to teach that class now for me. And one of the ways that I engaged in my process of grieving, I think, was to go back into writing and try and recapture. And so what I wanted to do, I set myself a goal, and it was, could I try and tell somebody what it was like to go through those 11 months in a very short amount of time. I didn't want to write a novel about it. I just wanted to see, could I do snapshots? And so I wrote a three-part, very, very short thing called What I Miss, What I Don't Miss, and What Remains. And the part that I'm going to read to you is the end part of What Remains. So this is the narrator, who is me, reading about what is left. And there will be four paragraphs. Each one has an idea attached to it of what remains. And so I begin. What remains? Memory. In 1 second, I experience a year. This time last year, the bad news delivered, the operation completed, the prognosis falling as snow does in this part of the world, relentlessly, indifferently. I juggle images of you trying to shake away the fog of tumor, medication, radiation, chemo, pain, insisting you would triumph, begging me not to despair, occasionally feeling almost yourself again and delighting in the adventure of an afternoon's drive, with me the chauffeur now, and you taking over my navigator's seat. I remember swallowing hard when you hesitated and looked almost scared. Should we turn left or right to get home? Have we really lived here 20 years? Fear. Passed in the end from you to me, you growing lighter by the second as your ragged breaths released it finally, me becoming slower, more uncertain the farther from me you travel. It lives here, filling the house the way our laughter once did. My heart pounds, but not from love's solidity, not from the unexpected and so doubled delight of chancing upon you. It is this heart-stopping thought, gone, forever, that creates my arrhythmia, a staccato of sorrow. Absence. How can nothing be so heavy? How does nothing craft such agony? Everywhere I look, your absence mocks space, violates the dimensions of the room. Your absence brushes up against these poor remains and tosses them easily aside, insisting upon its primacy over them and me. In its presence, rage is an impotent whimper. You are gone, but I am the one who is lost.
Wow, that's great.
Thanks.
God, that's really wonderful. And that must have been cathartic for you.
It was. I mean, it took a long time to get it down into this form, and it took a longer time to be able to read it out loud. But, yeah, it helps me to remember, and it helps me to remember that she's still with me. I mean, and that's very important. That's the other part of the writing, I think, that's so important for people, that it is a way that we insist what was still is in some form.
And to be able to turn rage into a healing poetic process.
Yeah, it's a good thing.
It's a good thing for everybody, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Let's begin to talk about the healing muse and the history of it, and that it's tied right into this, what
Great,
we're talking
yeah,
about,
I would,
right?
I would love to. You mentioned at the beginning of the show that we just have celebrated our 10th year.
Mm-hmm.
The Healing Muse was a journal started by Bonnie St. Andrews, who was a poet, a very wonderful poet. And Bonnie was teaching more in the College of Nursing at Upstate than she was in the College of Medicine. And she had a very wonderful, warm relationship with her nurses. And she was constantly trying to get them to write, because it has been traditionally true up until fairly recently that physicians were more presumed to be the writers and nurses just didn't do it. But nurses obviously are at the bedside all the time too, and they have many wonderful stories to share. So Bonnie's thought was, if she could start an in-house journal and keep it within Upstate, she would prepare the way for people to start thinking about writing as something that they did. And so the first year of the Healing Muse in 2000 was open only to students and clinicians at Upstate. But by the second year, Bonnie thought, you know what, we should go bigger with this. We should open this to everybody in Central New York. Anybody who has an experience dealing with medicine or illness or healing. Let's open it up. And so we did. And then, of course, the irony was that she fell ill in the third year and had to step down as editor.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Deirdre Nealon. She's the editor of The Healing Muse, which is what we're talking about at this very moment. So go on with this narrative. Tell us what the philosophy behind the Healing Muse became when you expanded it.
Yeah, the philosophy for the Healing Muse is really quite simple. Our goal is to encourage a dialogue that, through people's sharing their own individual experiences of illness or healing, when other people read them, other people start to talk about what it is the writer or the artist crafted. And we have the journal prominently displayed in our hospital, for example, in the waiting rooms. Mm. What I'm trying to do now is to get the physicians to want to buy a copy of this, as well as that old Field and Stream magazine that they have in their waiting room.
The Reader's Digest.
Yes, or the Reader's Digest from, 2000. I think it would be great for people to have this copy here, because what I think starts to happen is people start to talk to each other about, wow, that's what radiation was like, or, oh, that's what happens after surgery, or this is what it's like to lose somebody, or this is what it's like to come back. You're different, but you're back.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
So the philosophy behind our journal is we want quality writing, and the emphasis oftentimes is on some aspect of healing, illness, diagnosis. We are very much open to clinicians accessing us and writing for us, but we also want the patients and the families, the caregivers, mm-hmm. Because they have many wonderful, poignant stories to tell.
And I think it would be so valuable for physicians to read this Healing Muse magazine every year.
I agree with you.
It's an amazing education to see what people go through.
Yeah, I think so.
And it's told in poetic terms. They don't have to just see the rage. People have worked through and been able to really articulate in a poetic manner.
Yes.
How they feel.
And I think, Tish, for me, what's been really nice is seeing the progression, not just in terms of that we're getting more and more people who want to write for us, and I think we're getting higher quality all the time, too, but we are getting more from nurses and physicians. And they are now seeing what it does for them to try and write what it was like to be with that patient. And I think that it's been, hearing their testimonials about, wow, this really, I now understand what that patient was talking to me about is great.
Oh, it is. Absolutely. And I love that the founding editor, Bonnie St. Andrew, said that art and science are joined at the heart.
Yes.
I think that was wishful thinking, but I think the Healing Muse is making that happen.
Yeah, I think it was wishful thinking on her part, but she had a wonderful life-affirming sense about medicine. It scared her, but it also delighted her. I mean, when she first started, she used to go and get permission to witness certain surgeries.
Wow.
And so she went to see open-heart surgery, and then she wrote a beautiful poem that I think preserved the dignity of the patient as well as the artistry and dignity of the surgeons and nurses who were in that particular arena.
That's funny that you bring that, because my next question was going to be about how do physicians and nurses, when they are going to write about their experiences with patients, make sure that privacy is...
Yeah, that's a big concern for everybody and always for us too. We have a policy about confidentiality, and we recommend to physicians and nurses that if they are going to write about a patient, that they ask the permission of the patient. Mm. We have many wonderful stories of patients who have actually loved sitting down with the physician or nurse reading the piece and seeing themselves through the eyes of this clinician, but also then being able to talk about what that experience was like for them as well. So if patients do give permission and the piece is nonfiction, then, obviously we will publish it. A fiction piece has a different venue maybe in terms of fiction is fiction, but mm-hmm. My co-editor and I, Rebecca Garden, we're always talking about this concept of who owns the story. I think that when you're a fiction writer, you do use your family, for example. I mean, there's many wonderful examples of writers whose families no longer speak to them because...
Those are not exactly wonderful examples.
No, they're not wonderful examples, but it does happen. And
yes,
I think that... And I'm from the school of thought that thinks that that sometimes happens. Now, when you're dealing with people who are sick, obviously that's a very vulnerable, fragile population, and you would not, I would hope anyway, ethically use somebody's story without... their permission.
Yeah, I would think not either. I would think not either. Now, I before we run out of time, I want you to read an excerpt from Bonnie St. Andrews, the founding editor, to tell us about this piece. It's called Topography, the Brain Scan.
Yeah, I'd love to do this, Tish. This was very funny that Bon had a brain scan done years before she was diagnosed with a brain tumor. There was a different problem. She had fallen, and they wanted to do a brain scan. And she was... a little bit intimidated by that experience of the CAT scan and the MRI and what it was like to be in there. And anybody who's listening who's had one of these, you know it's pretty overwhelming at first. You have to lie very quietly, and there's this constant drumming that goes on while the machine does its work. After Bonnet had had it, she talked to her physicians, and she said, you know, I want you to go over with me the x-rays. I want to look at the scan with you. I want to understand what I'm looking at. And so she wrote this poem about her own brain scan in an attempt, she said, to take away a little bit of the mystery from someone who might be going to have one. So the excerpt that I'll read is just the second half of this poem. And she's looking at the actual slides of her brain. And it goes shot by shot. So it starts here. Shot 6. Clean as mitosis shows the walnut shell split down its center, each side a winged maple seed that makes a child's whistle. Then, sudden, shocking, bright as night mushrooms, two bulbous moons rise, your eyes surrounded by rock and spongy as Play-Doh. In this sleight of mind, one marvel follows another. But when the great brainstem sprouts into view, you know this is a godly thing, like a single braid announcing a pharaoh's child. This is the true royal coil. By shot 22, you can see every hole in your head. Your brain spread out like some gigantic Rorschach blot. Kali rises from flame. One powerful O'Keefe flower stirs in your windless sky. At its bottom, the widening brain is a horseshoe crab scuttling over a silent, boulder-strewn shore.
That's great.
It's really lovely, and if we weren't on radio, I could show you the scan of her brain, and you'd see exactly what it is that she's describing.
I've always thought the human body looked like under the ocean, and that's what that reminds
it
me
does.
Of.
It does, yeah, you're right, you're right.
Yeah, mysterious, mysterious. Now, one of your other areas of interest is cultural diversity in healthcare, according to your biography.
Yes.
Tell us what you mean by that. In regard to care or in regard to different cultures being thought about in regard to...
Yeah, you know, the changing demographics in the United States have led medicine into taking a really critical look at itself. The Institute of Medicine issued a report in 2002 that was called Unequal Access, and it looked at who was receiving what kinds of care. And it tried to factor out things like age, insurance, et cetera. And after factoring out those aspects, they discovered that there are certain classes of people who do not seem to receive the same quality care that other people do. And what was very important in the report was that it had nothing to do with physician attitudes. In other words, they were not trying to say that there is a racist or ethnic bias in medicine.
So what did it have to do with?
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? I think it's the way that we're brought up, that we assume in medicine you are being taught what's called a biomedical model, and that is all about disease. But in culture, depending on where we come from, we have different ways of thinking about illness. And some cultures see certain illnesses differently and have different modalities that they want to approach the disease with. Mm. And physicians, sometimes if they don't know about that, overlook what the patient might be doing on his or her own that might be counteracting what the physician is prescribing. So when you ask me about cultural diversity, I mean, I'm a person who likes people, and I often assume that most people who go into medicine also like people. I mean, you go in there because you want to help people. As our country changes, we have to be aware that not everybody thinks about health in the same way, mm-hmm. or how to approach a particular what we used to call the clinical encounter. For some cultures, for example, to be seen by a physician of the opposite gender is inappropriate.
Yeah.
For some cultures, language is a barrier. And although the hospitals now have laws that require us to provide interpreters, there are also times that people just kind of slide over that because they'll say, well, in the interests of time, I've got this patient's child here. The child can serve as an interpreter.
Wow.
And what you discover is that, you know, children sometimes don't even know what the physician might be talking about, or sometimes a person will bring a family friend, and that person may not want to deliver the news that the physician is attempting to give. For example, we used to, in this country, have a big taboo against saying cancer. You're too young to remember, but we didn't used to put that even in an obituary because it was almost a shameful thing for one to have cancer. Now, of course, you know, we have the breast cancer awareness campaigns and the pink ribbons and stuff, and it's people are very much out in front talking about cancer.
And all diseases, too. And there were taboos against AIDS during the early days of AIDS.
Yeah, that's another great example.
And now we do. We have cultural organizations that are actually advocating and going on TV. And
exactly.
It's an amazing change.
It's an amazing change. But when you have different cultural groups coming, like in Syracuse, for example, we are a big place for immigration. Many immigrant groups are sent to Syracuse. And these people come to us with, obviously, a language barrier in terms of English, but they also come sometimes from places where cancer still is something that we don't want to talk about.
Wow, so there are
cultural imperatives that it's really good for physicians and nurses to know about so that they can ask those open-ended questions so that the patient can let them know what it is you want to know, what you don't want to know, or if you have, we have in ethics autonomy. We talk about autonomy in the West. Every patient has the right to know everything.
Yeah.
But there are certain cultures in which autonomy plays a second fiddle to the family, that it's the family that will make decisions for an individual.
And I've heard a lot of physicians tell me that there are a lot of patients who don't want to know.
Yes.
And so the physician, in some ways, is on his or her own.
Exactly. And it's very difficult. It's very scary because all of a sudden, you know, what are you going to do with that? And so one of the things that cultural diversity helps us with is to know we don't know all the answers. One size doesn't fit all. And the best clinicians are what they've always been, the people who actually listen. Ask the patient, what is it you want to know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, we are almost out of time. I want to ask you one last question about the healing muse. Obviously, you have to reject certain works. What are you looking for? Just beautiful writing, or?
Yeah, we're always looking for something that grabs us. In other words, we're reading all the time, and I have read probably a million poems about breast cancer.
Mm-hmm.
One might think, could there possibly be another way to talk about this? And there is. There's always your way of going through it that grabs me, a total stranger. I mean, this is the challenge of writing that I think is so exciting. It's you don't know me and I don't know you, but we have a moment of intense intimacy when I start to read your poem or essay and it stops me.
Yeah.
And I think, wow, you know, here's Alzheimer's again. But it stopped me. And so that I can't really be more specific than to say we're looking for a work that makes us put down our pen for just that second and say, whew, loved it.
That's great. And what are you personally working on right now? Are you working on any essays? Or?
I just finished one, actually. Again, it's still, I tried to make this one a short story, but it is, again, about the anger one goes through when a serious illness with a dire diagnosis gets to one. So it was fun for me to try and make this all up out of whole cloth. So that's, and I've got a memoir that I am working on, but that's about it.
And what about contact information for the Healing Muse? So people,
you can find us on thehealingmuse.org. Very easy. We have a wonderful website. It's pretty friendly. Just go there and write to us.
It's a wonderful website. Well, Deirdre Nealon, thank you so much for joining us. This has been a great pleasure. Deirdre Nealon is an associate professor of bioethics and humanities at SUNY Upstate Medical University, and she's also the editor of The Healing Muse. Thank you so much.
Tish, thank you. This was great.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. If you'd like to make a tax-deductible donation in support of the Out of Bounds radio show, please contact our fiscal sponsor, the Arts of the Southern Finger Lakes, at earts.org. That's earts.org. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.